This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. We have with us in studio to begin Purdue University Northwest English professor Carolyn Boyarsky, who has written a book that looks into the effects of miscommunication within organizational communication. She has some good examples, and one of them in particular is here in Northwest Indiana. We'll find out more about that. Also, too, we have another conversation from the Welcome Project of Valparaiso University for you. And a little later in the hour, we're going to bring you highlights of the post-debate news conference that was held after the U.S. Senate debate between incumbent Joe Donnelly and Mike Braun. And Lucy Brenton. It happened, of course, at Purdue Northwest in Westville. We'll have some of the comments that at least two of the three candidates have to make. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Our guest is going to talk about, in particular, the importance of, regardless of what your profession or your field of study is, if you're still a student, you have to know how to communicate. And this particular topic is important because she's been able to show through her books, and this in particular we're going to talk about today, is how proper communication can resolve a lot of issues. And you've actually had some local examples in your book. We have with us in studio Purdue University Northwest English professor Carolyn Boyarsky, who has written several textbooks and other books related in her field in English and in communication. But she's more, I guess, involved now with working with the School of Engineering and in some of the topics that you have brought up. And the latest book that we're going to look into in particular is entitled Risk Communication and Miscommunication. And Carolyn Boyarsky, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much, Chris.
Well, we've gotten to start here talking about the fact that you're an English professor who has gotten into the engineering fields, talking about communication. What have you found in your field of study that engineers and any technical people need to know, in particular, about how to communicate with the general public?
Actually, Chris, I got into this in my first career, which was both as a writer, reporter, and then doing consulting for industry in terms of the nuclear power industry. Mm-hmm. And I had an opportunity in working with these nuclear engineers to see what some of the problems were that related to their communicating with each other, with their managers, to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And that got me really involved and interested in working with engineers in general.
When you have a chance to work with people that are not liberal arts majors, to be sure, or maybe even never got or even dreamed of getting a liberal arts degree for that matter, which is where I know that we typically think that communicators come from. When you get to turn these folks who are very technically minded into communicators, what are some of the challenges that you have discovered that you run into?
I think the biggest challenge is to help engineers or anyone writing recognize that they are writing for a reader. And this is true of electronic media as well. Mm-hmm. That it's, what does the reader, how is the reader going to respond to what you've written? And most people simply write what they want to say without thinking about the reader's response. This has become especially problematic today because we're used to just texting, we're used to tweeting. And it's a series of, I feel this way and out it comes. The problem is in professional writing, if you need some information, if you need people to do something, then you need to consider what is the information they need to know and how do you present it so they will do what you want them to do, respond to your request in the way you'd like them to do it.
In our conversation here before we went on air to talk about some of the issues that technical people face, we've talked here about the fact that they're really, although I know there are job titles that are still out there and people who work under them, there's no such thing as a technical writer hardly anymore, that we find people that are very technically minded are kind of put into these jobs. For example, somebody who has to write information that would go into a handbook or an instruction manual for some piece of equipment, they have to certainly know the equipment well enough to be able to write about it, but it's difficult, I imagine, for them to be able to write clearly enough and so that anybody, the average person, could pick up the manual and try and understand what you're talking about.
Actually, it's the technical writer can learn about the technical field to the point where he or she can explain it, because he's learned how to write so that it explains to a reader. It's the engineer or the technologist who has difficulty. One of the things they do in Caterpillar when they come out with a whole new machine is they literally tear it down in front of the writer and then put it back together so the writer can watch what they are doing, so that the writer understands how the machine works. When you're dealing with engineers, they already know how it works, but they don't realize they're talking to people who don't know how it works. And Enbridge, we're talking about people in the area.
Right. That was one of the examples that in your book that you bring up here. There are some examples of good communication and bad communication. And one of the examples that you mentioned of good communications was done by Enbridge Pipeline Company here in Northwest Indiana. For people that maybe are not familiar with how Enbridge fits into this, tell us first and explain how they seem to be a good example of how you can properly communicate.
When, or sometime shortly after, they had one of the worst leaks in the history of the United States of oil leaks, where over 1 million gallons had leaked out along the Kankakee River in Michigan, they began to enlarge their pipelines so that they could bring more oil down, gas down from the north up in Canada, Alaska,
and we're talking
Dakota.
We're talking about the shale oil coming out of,
particularly
out of Canada. Yeah.
And they have a headquarters right here in Griffith,
right,
which meant that they were going to be expanding the size of their pipes by about 3 times. They were also, in doing this, there would also be a lot of trucks, a lot of traffic in the area. They needed to reassure the community of Griffith and those people who lived right around where they were located that this was safe. And people were already coming from an idea of having heard about that Kankakee leak. So they put together a slide presentation in which they really were able to present what they were doing, and how all of the safety features that they were putting in would work. And they explained it in a way that anyone could understand. And then they went around to a lot of the organizations in the region and talked about what they were doing, so that the community would feel safe. And it was one of the best slide presentations I've ever seen, in that it explained it to the point where anyone could understand it, including this English literature major sitting here.
I know that in the years during that construction project that they put through, in not only putting in the pipes, the expanded pipeline itself, but also building entirely new tank farms on the south edge of Griffith. And in fact, you can pass those tanks on Avenue H, which is just south of the railroad tracks between Highland and Griffith to the south and west. But you see those tanks there, and that was all part of the project, I know. They had to explain why they were out there, why they were doing all that work, and why people that would drive out there all the time would have some traffic jams because of the construction crews that are out there working. It's probably not an easy task to try to explain to the average person what this complex project was all about.
Well, it's not easy, and there will always be people who will complain, but I think their presentation was one of the best I've seen in attempting to assure a community that they were taking all precautions that they could.
We're talking with Purdue University Northwest English professor, English literature professor, Carolyn Boyarsky, who has written a number of books here on communication, and in particular with business and industry, teaching people in business and industry how to better communicate, explain to the general public in many cases what the projects are. In this particular book, we've taken up the issue of a good piece of communication with the Enbridge Pipeline Project in Indiana. And you have also some examples of miscommunication in particular in one other area in particular, and of course a nationally known bad example of miscommunication. Will you explain those, please?
Well, a very bad form of miscommunication occurred over in the Chicago flood in 1992. And I always like to talk about that because I think it is absolutely the perfect model of miscommunication. It was done in a way that it could have been totally prevented if the communication had been appropriate for the people who were involved. The flood, the hole in the tunnel walls had been discovered in January. And it was a company that had strung cables. And the company saw it, contacted the city of Chicago to let them know there was this hole in a wall. And then the city did send someone down to take a look at it. He couldn't find a parking place, so he came back. By the time they really looked at it and got someone down there, the wall was crumbling. Well, he came back. He took a couple pictures. He came back, and they had meetings and decided they now would work out how they would fix it. And eventually, they sent a note to the head of that department. Well, it turns out the head of that department was new. He was acting. He was in finance, not an engineer. And they had not taken any of that into account. And so he thought this was just another piece, like one of the potholes in Chicago, and took his time, told everybody to put out a bid for it. They did. The bid was way high, so they put out another bid. And when the bid finally, before the bid, second bid came in, the flood occurred. Mm-hmm. Had anyone taken into consideration that this man didn't know where this flood was in the financial district and the million-dollar mile and provided him with this kind of information, he might not have put it out for bid. He might have said, go ahead and take care of the problem. But without taking into consideration who their reader was, they omitted all this information that he never did know.
That's interesting. Another one, too, I know that you mentioned in the book, too, it was a problem dealing with a very famous oil rig explosion, the BP Deepwater Horizon explosion that happened, and how there was a great deal of miscommunication about that. We know, of course, the outcome of that, but how did the miscommunication in that particular case come about?
That was a problem of actually taking what we do in texting and tweeting and thinking about social media and how we communicate instead of thinking this is professional. A man on the rig, one of the engineers on the rig, emailed someone on land and said, we're having a real problem. The man on the line, on land, he was the manager, mm-hmm. wrote back and said, I'm sure this is a problem, but we can take care of it tomorrow. I'm going dancing tonight. That's really black humor.
It's rather tragic in many respects. Some very expensive black humor, certainly for BP, because it cost them billions and billions of dollars to deal with the outcome of that leak.
Along with the deaths.
That's right. And there are a lot of fatalities that happened as a result,
yes.
too. One other point that you mentioned as well, we talk here about BP Deepwater Horizon, about the disaster there, but also, too, that you mentioned the Columbia space shuttle breakup in the book, too, and some miscommunication there. How did that come about?
Well, that was it couldn't have been prevented. Mm-hmm. the problem, but they might have been able to get those astronauts home. There was an engineer there who recognized what the real problem was and wrote an email back to the engineers working on trying to solve the problem. If you remember, the Houston would not send a photographer, and they had no idea just how big the hole was or where it was. And when this engineer sent his email, he began something like, I know you guys are busy, and I know that sometimes I go flying off with the wrong answers, but I thought you all might want to. At this point, nobody is going to bother reading further. He eventually did hit exactly what, just about what was going to happen, somewhere around the middle of the third paragraph, which is where a lot of people put information that is what is the really necessary information. I've sort of called it third paragraph syndrome.
So if they put it up in the top of the message or even in the second paragraph, there would have been better likelihood that somebody would have seen it and taken the proper action?
First paragraph.
First paragraph. I mean, it'd be
absolutely
better, wouldn't it?
Yes. First paragraph. If you do not put something in that first paragraph that will keep the reader's attention, the reader will not read further. We don't read word for word memos, letters, correspondence. We skim or scan them. And research shows that we do this in a T formation. We read that very first part, and then if we are going to read further, we go down the middle if it's hard copy. It's an F pattern if it's on a computer. We read across the top, we start down the left column, and then we might read a little more second paragraph if we're that interested, and then we continue down the left column skimming. So if it's stuck somewhere in the middle, you will never see it.
Do you think that we just end up needing a new procedure of being taught on how to read email messages of any kind?
No, I think we need a new procedure on how to write them.
Mm-hmm.
We are all going to read this way. So what we believe is that writers need to know how we read and then to write so that we will pick up what we read. We're too busy. There's too much out there, too much information we have to stop and really read things carefully. Nobody's going to do that. We have to recognize that and then begin to write so that we do provide the information, the details that people need at the beginning so that they can follow what we are trying to tell them.
Well, Carolyn, thank you for spending time with us to explain more about this particular book that you have out, Risk Communication and Miscommunication, some case studies in science, technology, engineering, government, and community organizations. Very long title, but a very, very important topic to bring up here is some of the things that that any of us need to know in how to write emails and other messages so that the right people get the right message all the time. We appreciate you taking some time to explain this to us, and we hope to have you back again soon.
Thank you. I hope to.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
When somebody tells you you have cancer, you'll try anything. You know, if somebody says walk around with an egg on your head and this period, I might be wearing a hat, but I'll have the egg, you know. Well, originally I was diagnosed with renal cell carcinoma back in 1996, which is the name for kidney cancer. And so I had the kidney removed in 1996, and it was thought that it all was gone. Somehow in 2007, it turned up in my lungs and liver and some in my brain. That particular cancer has no cure. And the best that you can do is to keep it stable. And if you can do that, you can be okay. Attitude has a lot to do with your health. I think music helps me in that way, having something to look forward to and having something else to think about even, because I'm writing a lot and I'm playing a lot. I'm not sitting around moaning and groaning about I have cancer. I feel like I've gotten a shot across the bow here, and I better get moving. You know, and I feel fortunate in that manner. You know, you might go out and get hit by a car right now and not have that warning. Some of the projects that you intended to do next year might not get done. If you have it in the back of your mind that every day is precious and some things you might not get done, then you get busy doing some of the things that are important to you. I feel that we all are put here for certain things to do. And I think mine is music, you know, and if I can make people happy, and if I can leave some pieces behind that'll make people happy listening to them even after I'm gone, then I think that's important. It's a great feeling to compose music. I feel like it's great when you hear back what you've composed. I think everybody has a talent, and I feel somewhat like like all these things are floating around and being transmitted by the Creator, and we all are like radios, and all of us are tuned to whatever channel we tune into, and some can pick up this thing. Like, I'd be no good at math, I'm afraid. But somebody's tuned to the math station, and they can get that. I happen to be tuned to the music station, and I can pull that in, you know. Plus, I think music has a spiritual aspect to it. There's some people that are even experimenting with certain intervals can cure certain things, you know, certain sounds can cure certain things. I think if I find the interval that cures cancer, I'm going to be pounding on it. All the rest of my compositions will be based around that. Audience will be saying, that sounded like the last thing he played. But at any rate, you know, I think the music is very helpful.
You can find more regional stories at Welcome Project. That's one word, welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have for you some of the comments that were made in last evening's post-debate news conference that was held after the first of the two U.S. Senate debates. It was held by the Indiana Debate Commission in Westville. That was, of course, on the campus of Purdue University Northwest. We had in this post-debate news conference two of the three candidates for U.S. Senate. The incumbent, Joe Donnelly, a Democrat, Libertarian Lucy Brenton, and Mike Braun, the Republican candidate, declined to participate in the post-debate event. So we have for you some comments made first by Lucy Brenton, the Libertarian candidate, and then following her, we have incumbent Democrat Joe Donnelly.
First, I'd like to say thank you to the Indiana Debate Commission for being a truly nonpartisan, respectful, and just quality organization. I don't discount at all the privilege that I have as a third party to be in the debates. We've done the hard work in the Libertarian Party in Indiana for decades to make sure that we have ballot access. In fact, the reason that we have ballot access is because people like Mark Rutherford, our Secretary of State candidate, stepped forward to run and to really run great campaigns, which is where the linchpin is for the debate access in Indiana. So I'd really like to thank the media as well for coming out. I think what we learned this evening is that if you continue to vote the same way you've always voted, you're going to continue to get what you've always got. Two things come to mind. First is Albert Einstein, who said, the same kind of thinking that got you into the problem that you're in is not the same kind of thinking that's going to get you out of the problem. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But we live in a country right now that is completely divided, and it's absolutely ridiculous. Whether you're wearing a red jersey or a blue jersey, it's clear that those in Washington have one mission in mind. That is to control you and the tax dollars that flow from you. It's time to do something completely different. It's time to vote for Lucy. Why? Because I'm the only one that is not beholden to corporate interests. I'm the only one that can actually say, no, I will not go over and cross party lines and collaborate with someone whose sole goal is to raise taxes on the American people. At some point, someone has to draw a line in the sand, say enough is enough. And as I ended the debate this evening, I said, you know, Trump said he wants to drain in the swamp. All we're going to do with those two is add another alligator. Thank you for asking, because there's a distinction to be made here. I'm a woman. I've had my Me Too moments. It's terrifying, but here's what I know. Kavanaugh co-authored the Patriot Act. Kavanaugh has decisions that strip rights from Americans, rights that are guaranteed by the Constitution. Kavanaugh is no friend of the Constitution. He's no friend of mine. It's very important that the government recognize that all people are equal. And unfortunately, what we have right now is the 13th Amendment of the Constitution, which actually guarantees slavery in this country. Before the 13th Amendment, slavery was not enshrined in the Constitution. Now it's actually a part of the Constitution. I challenge all of you to look at the issue of our private prisons and how those are kept full by politicians to pay off the builders and the profiteers of those private prisons. This is one of the reasons why I'm absolutely for recreational marijuana, and I advocate that all nonviolent people who are in prisons as a result of using a substance to change their state of mind be immediately released and their records expunged, simply because of that issue. Thank you for bringing it up. Mm-hmm. I would not be a vote to ban abortion, and I'll tell you why. I'm a woman, and I'm a mother. I'm a sister. I'm a daughter. As a woman who's been pregnant many times, I've given birth to 10 children, after all, I've had to face that very issue. And as heartbreaking as it is, that only lies up to the woman and her conscience, because she's the one that has to carry it. I think we can all agree that federal funds should not be used for abortion. Really, any other health care. But let's start there. Let's start with not funding it. And then we can relegate that to the states' rights. We can talk about the 9th Amendment, the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, and we can put those pieces where they belong, back to the states. Oh, gosh, what a great question. What have I learned from 2016 to 2018? The more things change, the more they stay the same. I'm disappointed in the last 2 years that in spite of all of our efforts, we've not gone towards more liberty, but we actually have less. We now have a new Supreme Court justice who has a terrible record with Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights, somebody who's willing to look through the lens of government and decided it was okay, that surveillance is okay, that restricting your rights is okay. China right now is facing a social credit score. If you haven't seen this, please look into it, where the technology is actually being used to decide whether you deserve to be able to go on a train or get on a bus. We don't need that kind of surveillance here. And I think Kavanaugh's the one who may give it to us.
Thank you all for being here. I can't say I'm surprised Mike Braun left and didn't talk to you, but you came from a lot of places. This is a profession I have an incredible amount of respect for, and the people of our state have a right to hear the issues, have a right to hear questions about the issues, and I'm really glad we have this opportunity. I think what this debate showed more than anything is you can't trust Mike Braun. You can't trust him on health care, where he says he's for coverage of pre-existing conditions, but he supported the Senate bill that would have taken pre-existing conditions coverage away. He supported the House bill that would have taken pre-existing conditions coverage away. And he supports the lawsuit, Texas versus United States, that is a dagger aimed at the heart of every family who has a member who has pre-existing conditions. I asked him to renounce his support of that on the stage. He refused to do so. And at Meyer Distributing, the health care that he has a deductible of $10,000. $10,000. And wages are $12 an hour. So you're making around $23, $24. Your deductible is $10,000 before you can get your first prescription. That's not health care. I talked about taxes. Mike Braun says he's a low taxer. He was responsible for 45 tax increases in the state legislature, the largest increase in the history of the state, and then gave himself a tax cut, and then quit and went home. He talks about effectiveness. How effective are you when you quit on the people of Jasper and go home, the people who elected you? When you quit on the people of Southern Indiana? When you quit on the people of the state of Indiana? In regards to our troops. Time after time he had the chance to say that he does support a pay increase for men and women. I was responsible in part with all of my colleagues for the largest pay increase for our men and women who serve in 9 years, who are in Iraq, who are in Afghanistan, who are all over the world protecting us and keeping us safe. Mike Braun didn't support that. And he supported a cut in our defense budget. He talked about Secretary Mattis, how awesome he was. Let me tell you, Secretary Mattis is awesome. He's amazing. And he supported that budget. And I supported that budget. Because I want to make sure our men and women are never, ever in a fair fight. When we have a kid, not even kids, because they're men and women who serve our nation. When we have people who serve our nation from Vincennes or from Washington, Indiana, or from Muncie, or from Jasper County, I want to make sure they're never, ever, ever in a fair fight, that they have everything on their side. And when Secretary Mattis sends me a budget, I fight for that budget. I'm on the Armed Services Committee. I'm involved in Strategic Forces. I'm the ranking member among many other subcommittees. And that requires me to be the lead Democrat in charge of nuclear weapons, nuclear deterrence, missile defense, all of these things. I know the budgets. I know the challenges. I know the threats that North Korea makes to our country. And it is astonishing to me that on something as basic as our defense budget, he wants to cut it. And so with that, I'll answer any questions anybody has. Well, the 45 combined was over $1 billion in tax increases to the state. So I'll get you the exact one. Okay?
You've said several times that you are the hired help. So
I actually didn't say it in the debate, but I am the hired help. You can count on that.
You've said it in
and who are you with, sir?
From the RV, and, with Network Indiana.
Okay, thank you.
You've said it from the RV. You know,
absolutely. And I am. I apologize for saying I didn't say it in the debate, but I was, you know. That's because I forgot to. So
I'm wondering, in a state that overwhelmingly supported Donald Trump, do you believe it was the people's decision? Do you believe it was the people's will that you vote against Judge Kavanaugh?
Here's what I believe. I believe that you're not only elected to represent the people, but they elect you with the experiences you have, the judgment you have, to try to make the right decisions for our country. And so during the financial crisis that we faced, some of the steps that were taken were really difficult steps. But they were necessary steps to bring our economy back. And on some of them, I got overwhelming mail saying, don't do this. We shouldn't do this. But I served on the Financial Services Committee. And I knew this at that time. I knew that if we didn't do something, the entire economy was going to crash around the world in the next 3 days. And so Hoosiers have been kind enough to give me this chance to take my collective experiences and make the best decisions I can. In regards to Judge Kavanaugh, you saw someone who wrote a Wall Street Journal op-ed to apologize for his behavior before the Senate committee. He apologized for the way he acted, for his lack of judicial temperament, for his lack of impartiality. And three of the tests I've always said from the start for judges who want to be at the very highest point for a Supreme Court justice. Part of my test was always judicial temperament, impartiality, and qualifications. That's why I supported Justice Neil Gorsuch. And that's why if Justice Neil Gorsuch was before us again, I'd be the first one in line to vote yes. I want to help President Trump with his judicial nominations. That's why I voted for 77% of them. Hoosiers should conclude that what I don't want to do is see him become our senator and take their health care away. That's what they should conclude. I mean, I talked about my record as well, my record for making sure on things like right to try, on things like working with the president on his NAFTA efforts. Across the board, time after time, 45 pieces of legislation passed, 23 under Donald Trump alone. Look, I'm a workhorse. I'm not a show horse. I don't spend all my time bragging about what I do or trying to make myself look better by screaming and yelling in Washington. You know, you have extremes on the left and on the right. My job is to get things done, and that's what I try to do. And I am worried that someone who won't support funding for the troops, who won't support health care for pre-existing conditions, that worries me. I mean, look, I had over 500 meetings last year. In the audience tonight, I didn't know they were there, but they came, were some parents who I met from South Bend. And they have triplets. And the triplets were born at 6 months, 3 months premature. And we're in an incredible medical time now. And they were in the neonatal intensive care unit for 3 months. When they left, they were handed a bill from the hospital, $5 million. Under Mike Braun, they're out $5 million, and they're wiped out because he's not for coverage of pre-existing conditions. He's not for lifting lifetime caps. I mean, he's made it clear. And so that's who I'm fighting for, are those families. And they still have their house and their car and their jobs, and the kids are doing phenomenal, and the kids are running around all the time and tearing a house apart. That's the way it should be in America. That's what we're supposed to do.
And Senator Joe Donnelly in the post-debate news briefing, along with Libertarian candidate Lucy Brenton from last night in Westville, GOP candidate Mike Braun declined to join them in that event. And our sincere thanks to Michael Puente, my public radio colleague, for recording those comments last night. The president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance, Steve Coxhead, with which is here on Regionally Speaking not long ago, to talk about, among other topics, the organization's near-term strategic goals. And here's that conversation.
The most immediate thing is improving the Hoosier State Service. Currently, the state of Indiana supports one train a day in each direction. As we go into the next General Assembly budget session, the push is going to be to double that, so we have two trains a day in each direction, which, as you can imagine, makes travel planning for any purpose much easier. And it also pushes us up to the point where farebox can cover operating revenues. Beyond that, though, we've started to look as an organization as to ideally what you would want the state of Indiana to have to be competitive transportation-wise in the 21st century. And there's a lot of things building off the existing service that could really be a plus. For instance, extending the Hoosier State on a daily basis to Cincinnati. That would link the Cincinnati, Indianapolis, and Northwest Indiana, and by implication Chicago, with the Cincinnati metro area, which actually historically has been a very strong passenger market. Other things that could happen and have been talked about, let's say having a section, or actually resurrecting what used to be called the Kentucky Cardinal, which would link Louisville to Indianapolis, and time that to match the Hoosier State and the Cardinal arrivals and departures, and that would give us a link from Northwest Indiana down to Louisville, which would probably generate a great deal of traffic. Other things that have been talked about, for instance, are taking a section off of the Hoosier State or Cardinal at Indianapolis and running it over to St. Louis by way of, let's say, Springfield, Illinois. And that would give an alternative for transportation, between the center of our state and St. Louis, and also indirectly Northwest Indiana and St. Louis. So we're looking at those. We continue to support the Fort Wayne area's push for renewed service linking Chicago and Fort Wayne on to Columbus, Ohio, as well as looking at what we call light rail or commuter rail in areas other than Northwest Indiana. As you're aware, we're making progress expanding the South Shore up here to compete with the Chicago collar counties. There's also a growing demand for commuter services of some sort in central Indiana. The Indianapolis metropolitan area is expanding out into its own set of collar counties, and the highway network down there is becoming increasingly overloaded. There's interest in commuter rail from Indianapolis up through Anderson and Muncie, up through Noblesville and Tipton, and up through Frankfort into the Lafayette, West Lafayette area. So there's a lot that we could do. We don't have a master plan for accomplishing all this in the next General Assembly session. This is going to take quite some time and a lot of hard work. But in looking at what it will take to compete with other large metropolitan areas in the U.S. and also around the world, not only for business investment, but to attract the kind of workers, young, educated, mobile workers that people are going to need to work in 21st century businesses. So this is kind of the plan we've laid out, and we'll be expanding on that in future issues of the newsletter, and hopefully we'll be able to develop some traction as time goes by.
When you talk about all the ideas that you want to bring forth to the General Assembly, I'm sure many of them you'll probably bring forth at the start of before the next session coming up here.
Mm-hmm.
I know one of the things that you've talked about and you've insisted on that NDOT continue to support the Hoosier State financially and other areas too. But I understand too that everybody at the Alliance is very concerned about where some of the latest money that the state of Indiana is getting, that is to say the funds that are coming from the Indiana toll road and the increased tolls that are going to be levied onto trucks. But none of that is, I understand, going to passenger rail. Do you think there's any chances of making sure that some of that gets earmarked for passenger service?
Well, it's kind of a disappointment from our viewpoint because our understanding is that basically it's a done deal, that the allocations of the funding have already been made, and that in a political sense, this may have been what was necessary to get approval for Governor Whitcomb's deal. We are disappointed, though, if you look at a sum of $1 billion, and we have to remember this is a one-time thing, so it wouldn't be considered a continued source of funding. But, for instance, you could do some interesting things. You know, you could put up a state match for the Fort Wayne Group's project. You could make some improvements on the Hoosier State right-of-way that would improve reliability and performance. You know, start some studies about Central Indiana commuter rail, especially looking at, it's hard to complain too much about the money for roads because, many of us know that the state of Indiana is having a hard time raising the money to keep its roads in repair. So that's a problem. But we look at, I think there was like $20 million that was allocated to promote international flights out of the Indianapolis airport. Well, well and good, but when we attempt to propose rail projects, politicians often tell us, well, we don't want to subsidize things. Well, this looks like a $20 million subsidy to the Indianapolis airport. You know, it may be all well and good, but I think it cuts the ground underneath out from people who say, well, we don't want subsidies, for instance. Basically the public, and ourselves found out about this deal after it was done, where basically the state would give the owners or the leasees of the toll road the permission to raise the tolls, and in return they would make a one-time payment. Actually, I think it's in three or four parts
right,
the state
three.
Of Indiana. Looking at the fact that it was $1 billion, we're just disappointed that some of it, at least, couldn't have been allocated to promote rail in the state, especially because a few million would have gone a long ways towards starting some feasibility environmental studies, for instance. We always advocate a balanced approach, which would include both modern rail and modern highway. you know, as well as developing our aviation facilities.
We're talking with Steve Coxhead. He's president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance about what the alliance would like to see done as far as strategic planning for the future and working with the state legislature on these issues. I know that you and other members of the alliance have also had some concern here, and getting back to Amtrak, not so much, I guess, although you have concerns about the service, the Hoosier State, the Cardinal, and these other lines that I know that you mentioned that the strategic plan like to bring back into service, like the route to Kentucky and Indiana. But you've mentioned that in the past that you all are concerned about, I guess, the overall business model for Amtrak. Tell us about that.
Yes. You know, we have a new, you know, CEO and president at Amtrak, Anderson, whose previous job was over at Delta Airlines. And looking at the business plan he seems to be adopting for Amtrak, and mind you, we're criticizing not the individual but the plan itself. We just think he's got a wrong business plan, a plan that might have been, you know, appropriate and successful in the airline industries, but which we don't think works for passenger rail. And if you look at the approach he's been taking, it seems to involve cutting service, you know, in terms of cutting the number of places that are served by Amtrak system, eliminating a service component, you know, by which I mean to say is eliminating staffing at stations, eliminating onboard services, downgrading meal service and so forth. And there seems to be a sometimes not so subtle push to eliminate long distance trains outside of the East Coast. An example is the Southwest Chief, which links the Chicago, Northwest Indiana area to Los Angeles. And one proposal was, well, you know, Amtrak, you know, is going to have to pick up some of the heavy lifting for maintaining tracks in the middle of that route. So we're just going to cut the route into two segments, and we're going to have a bus shuttle between the two segment ends.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone that's been involved with passenger rail development, you know, would know that this would positively kill the service. And in fact, things like this were done in the 60s and 70s by railroads that wanted, you know, before the advent of Amtrak, when they wanted to justify killing service. They would remove a key segment, then they would go to the federal government and say, well, look, there's no passengers. We think Anderson and Amtrak has backed off from this in the case of the Southwest Chief. But it just seems to be the idea of cutting the service back to decrease costs, as opposed to providing the kind of world-class transportation service I think most people in this country would want if they were to stop and think about it. When you look at the airline industry now, you see a reduction in number of flights. You see a lot of communities have had a reduction in the number of flights serving their particular airport. We see a concentration on the hub and spoke concept, whereas the carrier really does nothing but shuttle passengers between major hubs. That may have some validity in the airline model, but in the railroad model, when you look at, for instance, like something like the Cardinal, it's you know, or the Hoosier State, it's not just serving two hubs, let's say Indianapolis and Chicago. It's serving places like Plainfield, Rensselaer, Dyer, Crawfordsville, Lafayette. So if you look at a hub and spoke concept, it's not really going to work for rail, because rail by its nature works best when it serves intermediate points. It's hard to make airliners serve intermediate points, so maybe that was appropriate for Delta. So what we seem to be seeing is that Anderson is taking a business model, which the airlines have used, and which may be appropriate in many cases for an air service, and applying it to what has always been intended to be a national passenger rail network. And we are just very much afraid that the man is charging full bore ahead with a business plan that's going to increase Amtrak's losses, make it even harder to finance, and make it harder for states like Indiana to work with. For instance, one of the great advantages to Indiana, we believe, in developing a 21st century rail system within the state is that it hooks into a national network, you know, so you can start out in various places in Indiana, get to and from numerous places, you know, within the country. So we're very much dependent upon the existence of that national network and its viability. even though our own organization, you know, is focusing primarily on Indiana. Yeah.
Now, Steve, let me ask, and you were referred to this here in talking about the ideas that came up in the near-term strategic goals that the Alliance wants to make. And you're talking about reviving the Kentucky Cardinal service out of Louisville into Indianapolis. And then you also mentioned, too, about extending lines from Indianapolis back out to out west to St. Louis, which, of course, I'm sure would mean that the line would end up going through Greencastle and other places like that, places that the Hoosier State makes along the way, or the Cardinal makes along the way. So I suppose that it wouldn't kind of put the kibosh on those, would it? If it's working with the same thought process and business model that seems to be coming out of Mr. Anderson right now.
Yeah. The airline industry, if you'll note, has not been expanding its coverage in recent years. What we need Amtrak to do is admittedly expand its coverage, work with us, so we could make Indiana a rail crossroads, just like in many respects it's a road crossroads. And you're absolutely right. It's not just linking point A and point B. It's linking a whole bunch of smaller cities and towns. What we and other organizations have found, particularly in some other states surrounding Indiana, is that when you go out and look at smaller communities, it doesn't matter whether they're Republican, Democrat, or something else, these smaller communities all get very enthused at the idea of a modern rail link, you know, to the larger metropolitan areas. And I think that's one of the benefits we'd want to bring to Indiana by expanding service. And we really would need a viable Amtrak as a partner to do this unless something completely unforeseen happens. So, we're very concerned about these things.
One of the things I know that we have talked about sometimes off the air, but I think maybe it's worth mentioning in the program, is about how people that would like to find out more about the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance can find out more, and maybe they too might be able to get some line up some copies of the monthly newsletter to come out, so they can keep track of these issues and help pass the word along too. Give us the website address and how people can find out more if they'd like to get the newsletter.
Okay, the website address, and it harkens back to an older incarnation, it is IndianaHighSpeedRail.org.
That's easy enough to keep track of and find that way, too. And that one term, if you want to get a copy of All Aboard Indiana, which is the name of the newsletter, you can line that up that way, too, I imagine.
Yeah, there are copies available online. We have those out on the web as a PDF file, which is readable by most people's computers these days. If you want to send us an email, our email address is info@IndianaHighSpeedRail.org. And you could send a request to be put on the mailing list, a request for a hard copy of the newsletter, a question, a suggestion. So we're out there, definitely in the public.
Well, Steve Coxhead, thank you for spending time with us to talk about some of the latest concerns that the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance has about not only the Hoosier State and the other Amtrak lines that crisscross Indiana and come through Northwest Indiana in particular, but some of the other concerns that you have statewide about passenger rail service. And we'll be back with you again soon, I hope.
Thank you much, Chris.
You're welcome.
Pleasure.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back tomorrow.